You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
The idea of inventing secret codes and breaking secret codes, particularly between nations during war efforts, has been a source of fascination, hasn't it? Forever. You might remember that recent hit film with Benedict Cumberbatch, The Imitation Game, about the famous code breakers, including Alan Turing, who successfully decrypted the German intelligence messages for the British government during the war. Well, possibly the most important code-breaking event the world has ever seen, changing the course of history. Well, a little-known element to the real story of those code-breaking efforts for the Allies was that thousands of young code-breakers were recruited in this war effort, and 70% of them were women. The average age of these young women codebreakers was just 19. Yeah. Ellie Marnie is an author. Her latest novel is The Killing Code. It's an historical fiction largely based on the stories of these young code girls. And Ellie is in the UK and joins me now. Hello to you, Ellie.
Hello, Indira. How are you?
Well,
good morning from New York City. I'm actually in the US today.
Yeah, well done. There you go. So you're on book tour, I understand, promoting this.
We had a fantastic launch at Books of Wonder a little while ago, so that was really nice.
Oh, fabulous. Good to hear. Now, getting to the crux of your book, during World War II, we know there were two decryption locations where thousands of code breakers worked day and night to crack the unbreakable Nazi code machine. One of them was Arlington Hall in the US and Bletchley Park in the UK. And so tell us about these places. What were they before they became intelligence hubs, Ellie?
Bletchley Park was an area where the UK basically took over an old stately residence to locate their code breaking, or what they called their signal intelligence facilities there. And then there were a couple of other locations. I mean, we had one in Australia with Central Bureau in Melbourne that started up. It was going in full swing by 1942. It was in a place called Cranley in South Yarra. And they also had SPECINT, what they used to call special intelligence, at the Victoria Barracks in Melbourne. And the RAN Fleet Radio Unit was there. But Arlington Hall was the area that I focused on, and it used to be a girls' school. So it was, as soon as I read that, it used to be a finishing school for young ladies. That's when I realised that was my entry point for the story.
I know, that sounds so fascinating, that a ladies' finishing school can end up being a US signal intelligence headquarters. And what did you learn, Ellie, about these young women recruited to assist in the code-breaking efforts?
Well, first of all, I learned that a lot of them were very young. As you mentioned in your intro, the average age at Bletchley Park was 19 years old.
So young.
And So they were all basically, just out of high school, I guess. There were, largely teenage girls who'd been recruited out of high school or out of teaching colleges or universities in both the UK and the US.
And why young? And why young girls, Ellie? Young women?
Well, they originally sent out letters to them all asking them, did you like crosswords and were you engaged to be married? So they didn't want young women who were attached. They wanted people who were, basically unattached and unable to share secrets with, husbands or fiancés. Uh-huh. And why did they recruit them so young? I think all the young men were off at the war. They were all out fighting. So they did need a supply of people to do the very fairly boring paperwork tasks that were involved in code breaking.
And you describe how these women were very smart. They were stylish and they were capable and talented. About it attracted them to being code breakers?
Look, I think there was a strong sense of you know, everyone was pulling together to help the war effort. So these young women were interested in that. They wanted to contribute. There was this sense of collectivity around the war. And also they were highly encouraged by the government at that time. Their slogan was release a man to fight. So you would take over, a woman would take over the role that a man was performing in a factory or in an office. And if you had an opportunity to work for the government or work for the war effort in any way, then you took it. You know, there was they took an oath of secrecy around the work that they were doing, and they took the oath very seriously. So quite a lot of them didn't reveal that they had worked in signal intelligence until they were quite elderly, and some of them took the secret to their graves.
This is interesting, these oaths of secrecy that you say they had to swear to. Is that the reason we know so little about what they did? Because people like Alan Turing and his achievements are very celebrated, but these thousands of women, so little is known about them.
Yeah, look, I think now that the Official Secrets Act only expired, or they were released from their oaths when they're in the 80s and late 80s, early 90s. So a lot of them were very elderly. In fact, I've had a number of friends talk to me about people who they knew or women relatives. Another Australian author I know, Kirsty Murray, was saying that her mum used to work for the RAF at Victoria Barracks, and that was a whole aspect of her life that she couldn't really, or she didn't feel comfortable talking about or sharing. They were told that they wouldn't be spared because of their gender, that if they had broken the Official Secrets Act, they would go to jail, or in the US, treason at that time, if you broke the Espionage Act, was punishable by death. So, you know, it was a big deal that you'd taken an oath, you weren't supposed to talk about it. And there were a number of funny stories about the lengths that they went to keep their secrets close. The women who worked at Arlington Hall, which is located near Washington, D.C., they used to live together in bunks and dorm rooms and work together, and they'd often socialise together too. And there was a couple of stories about how when they would go out as a group, they had a secret code so that if someone from the general public started asking them questions about their work, one of them would buy a vodka Collins, and that was their cue to all split up and go to the bathroom separately, and then they would all leave separately. So they did take it very seriously. And they also had no expectation of recognition. You know, they really didn't take on this job to receive recognition or to be lauded publicly. It was just considered to be a patriotic and important thing to do.
You're with Indira Naidoo on Nightlife, and I'm speaking to author Ellie Marnie about her new book, The Killing Code. It's an historical fiction. She's researched true life stories of thousands of young girls, women who were recruited to break codes during the Second World War. You focus on a number of the women involved, and one of them is Anne Cara-Christie, who was recruited. How, you know, she's fascinating because she was a queer woman who later became the first female deputy director of the NSA, the National Security Agency.
Yes, she was an extraordinary woman, actually. She was recruited from university. And it's interesting because when I first started researching this book, I thought, oh, well, I'll be very interested in the lives of the women, but the code breaking will be beyond me because I'm bad at maths. But but the funny thing was that they initially recruited women from STEM disciplines, so maths and sciences and astronomy and things like that. But then later they expanded when they realised they needed more collateral thinkers. So Anne Cara-Christie was actually specialising in English and the humanities at university. And she was recruited. And they did, you know, recruit women from languages and music and people who were studying poetry. So, yeah, they took women from all over. And Anne Cara Christie was considered a bit of a superstar code breaker. She used to book break, which was break down the original code books that were used by the Japanese during the war. And then later on, she basically stayed in that role as a code breaker and continued working for the National Security Agency and then became the first female deputy director. It was a really extraordinary time for women, and it was also an extraordinary time for queer women because for the first time they could pass unnoticed and unremarked. Women were allowed to wear pants and congregate with other women and develop a career and an independent life. So it was actually, you know, a time when queer women had relatively open camaraderie and acceptance. You know, a lot of that was rolled back after the war. But, you know, it was interesting that World War II was the spark, was the beginning of that movement of community and solidarity for queer women at the time. And, yeah, I think most people didn't realise that Anne Cara Christie was queer until her funeral, surprisingly enough. She was quite elderly when she passed away, and it wasn't until they were reading her eulogy that they realised that her longtime companion had actually been her longtime partner for a very long period, decades.
So, Ellie, I don't know much about how you could actually break code. So how would someone without a mathematical persuasion or degree go about breaking a code?
Well, look, it was from my understanding and from looking at the paperwork involved, it was actually, it sounds very exciting to say, I'm a code breaker, but it involved a lot of extremely tedious, patient, attention to detail type work. You know, you were sitting at desks, you would start at 8 in the morning and you wouldn't finish until 4 in the afternoon. You worked in 24-hour shift rotation. You had 6 days on, 1 day off. And it was just a matter of pencil and paper and sitting there poring over lines of numbers or jumbled up letters and working out where you could see repetitions. Repetitions were particularly important. So anywhere where you had two numbers that matched together or they repeated from one line to the next, you would try to find those match-ups. And then they had cribs, which were sections of code that they think they had broke already. So they would go back to those and do a comparison. You know, It's just that boring attention to detail, that fine, finicky work that women were particularly accustomed to doing already in secretarial type roles, which made them perfect as code breakers. I mean, you mentioned Alan Turing at the start of this episode, and look, that's a really important thing to note too about code breaking, which is that we do tend to focus on the idea of this lone individual titanic genius, you know, who's often a man. But in the case of code breaking, that genius was very definitely collective. It was about collaboration, what they called a crew job. So it was a team effort of all of these women, and one woman would get a little part of the message, another woman would get another little part, and then there was whole groups of them all working together in one room, and they would all pool their efforts and work together, lots of people with very good memory.
To break that code. Cara Christie, Ellie, has said that the highlight of her career was victory over Japan, Japan Day, VJ Day, August the 14th, 1945. And according to the interview with the Veterans History Project, Cara Christie said by 2 o'clock that afternoon they knew messages that had been read and the war was going to be over. And she is quoted as saying, and the word went and swept like fire through there. And we were told that we were not to tell any of our friends and relatives until, you know, 4 o'clock or something. And then at 4 o'clock, we all just left the building and congregated in Washington to celebrate the great day. That must have been so extraordinary for them to have this extraordinary knowledge for several hours that they couldn't share with anyone else. This huge knowledge they knew was going to change the course of history.
Yes, they knew. They broke the code of the Japanese surrender message well before anybody else in the public knew about it, of course. And then they had to just hold it close until that time came when they were allowed to, when the government officially released the news. So, yeah, it was a thrilling time, but it was also, a time of great sadness and poignance because they were hearing the news of boats that had been sunk or battalions that had been lost and, men who had died in the field. So they actually experienced a lot of stress and trauma as well around hearing about the deaths of, husbands and sons and brothers and lovers. So on the one hand, they got the news early, but not all of it was good news. So it was a really difficult time, I think. And I think there was a lot of, it was a fairly profound psychological situation to be in. The women who were welcomed into the ranks as code breakers were encouraged to join up. They were encouraged to participate. But at the same time, there was a certain amount of resentment about the way women's roles had changed at that time. And the idea that you were releasing a man to fight also meant that you were potentially releasing a man to die. So, there was a lot of fairly complex psychological stuff going on at that time for the women that were involved.
Ellie Marney is the author of The Killing Code. She's with me talking about these young women who were recruited to break codes during the Second World War. Ellie, a listener has said that her English nana was at Bletchley with the Wrens. And she thinks that it's important that we remember these code-breaking shifts were really long, 12 hours on, 12 hours off, and very tedious. And she says her nana said she started smoking during this time to keep her awake.
Yes, I believe that. I would absolutely believe that. They just sat there on these hard wooden chairs hours and hours and hours, just sitting there, and quite cold conditions too, because, particularly in the UK, there was a lot of concern around rationing and you had to limit the amount of coal and oil that you were using for heating. So they would just rug up, they would put on every jumper that they had and their coat and their mittens and gloves and socks, three pairs of socks, and sit there in these freezing cold huts in Bletchley Park trying to work through these endless, seemingly endless bits of paper that would come in. There were, thousands of them arriving every day. And also with the awareness that if you didn't get the codes broken in time, that people would die. So, that was a very, even though it was tedious work, it was also fairly weighty work. You would have felt that heaviness when you were working.
Those lives in your hands.
Yeah, yeah. I received another message from a reader who was telling me that women worked in codes and we kind of assumed, I assumed, that that was mainly involved with women sitting down at these desks with pencil and paper, but they did work in lots of other capacities. So a reader wrote to me and told me that when her grandmother worked for the war effort in Australia, she used to, they needed a girl to bring the transcripts, the code transcripts, from Moorabbin Airport down St Kilda Road to Victoria Barracks. So she used to collect the transcripts from off the plane, pop them in her satchel, and then ride them on her motorbike down St Kilda Road.
And so when the war ended, what happened to these women? Because it must have been such an intense period of time for them. Where did they go?
Largely they went back to the homes that they'd left behind, the university courses that they had put aside, or the small jobs, or the Some of them would have gone back to their hometowns. It was a very post-war, a very tumultuous time because, of course, women during that period had experienced a complete sea change. It was a complete change in the attitude towards women's work and what sorts of things they could do and how they could contribute. So, you know, it would have been actually pretty tough, and you would have had a lot of mixed feelings, I think, about leaving a role that, although it was tough and mentally exhausting and physically tiring work, you would have had quite mixed feelings, I think, about returning to fairly mundane home life. And also, you wouldn't have been able to tell anybody what you did. People would have said, oh, what have you been doing for the last couple of years? And you would have said, oh, I've just been working in the city, you know, as a shop girl or as a secretary or something. You couldn't actually say, I worked with the government as a code breaker.
Saving hundreds of thousands of lives.
Yes. and they did end the war. Well, some estimates say that brought the war to a close a couple of years earlier than anticipated, which meant that they would have saved around 11 million lives. So it was a fairly critical role that they played, these young women.
Absolutely.
And then, at the end, they were told, oh, no, now it's time to go back to, you know, working at home or, you know, just resuming family life or study. And you have to, you know, abandon your pants and go back to wearing your skirts and, you know, no more earning your own money, that sort of thing. So
no recognition for what you'd done.
No recognition. I mean, as I said, none of them really had the expectation of recognition. But I think they would have missed most of all that collegiality and that opportunity to congregate and talk with other women. They all lived in very hothouse environments. Arlington Hall was particularly close because the women were living in the old dorm rooms for the girls' school, and then they would get up in the morning and go into their workrooms where they all worked together, and then when they had a night out, they would go out and socialise together. So that collaboration and collectivity with other women would have been quite, you know, completely unusual at that time. And I'm pretty sure they would have missed it.
Oh, yes. One of the things you say in your book, Ellie, about Cara Christie, the woman who went in to become the NSA deputy director, yes, is that she thought at the end of the war that the intelligence business in the United States would, you know, dwindle and diminish, if not disappear. So she got that completely wrong.
She did, yeah. She didn't anticipate that we would continue ramping up signal intelligence. I mean, code breaking hasn't stopped. Code breaking is still ongoing. Although these days, if you want to specialise in code breaking, you have to be basically a computer technician in order to work in that field now. But yes, there was, I think Cara Christie had hoped that after World War II was over, there would be a reduced need for this sort of thing. I think everyone who lived through the war had
those expectations.
Nothing like that would ever happen again.
Yeah.
But of course that never really happened.
Well, it's so important that you, through your research and your book, are giving these women the recognition that they didn't get all those decades ago. Ellie, so thank you so much for your book and all the best the rest of your tour.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks. Ellie Marney, who has written a book called The Killing Code, an historical fiction that she's researched these stories of these extraordinary young women, some as young as 18, 19, who played a pivotal role in breaking codes during the Second World War, and as she said, possibly bringing the war to a close 2 years old earlier, possibly saving the lives of 11 million people.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife.
You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.